Hello everyone, and welcome to the DavidCrit podcast. I'm your host, Britt Lawton, and today's episode is extracted from a conversation that took place between artist photographer Mikhail Subotsky and master printer from the US, Phil Saunders. The talk was hosted by DavidCrit Projects in partnership with the Goodman Gallery and moderated by associate professor and author Bronwyn Lawful Yun. The discussion delves into the print collaboration that took place between Mikhail and Phil at the DavidCrit workshop in 2017. The body of 8 prints is called the Four Quartet Series, Humorism, After Eliot and De Messina, and marks the artist's first venture into printmaking. You can also watch the full conversation in video on our website and our YouTube channel. Links to the video and artist page can be found in our show notes. Enjoy!
I'm Bronwyn Lawful Yun, and I am very pleased to have been invited to chat to Phil Saunders, who's a printmaker from the US, who's been coming to South Africa for a number of years to work at DavidCrit with Jill and her team. And over the years, I think I met you about 10 years ago, Phil, was that
about your first
trip to South Africa was? When Jill was still working out of Jan Smuts in the space there, in the print workshop. And I think one of the first things that you did in that workshop, Phil, was to show the team how to steel face plates, which made a huge difference to their ability to produce larger editions. So that was my first introduction to Phil as a printmaker. And as somebody who was very interested in, I think part of what Phil brought to the print workshop here was really interesting and extraordinary experience in various printmaking techniques. So his background in printmaking and the kind of work that he'd done, mostly in New York at that stage, but with various printmaking workshops, meant that he had a wealth of knowledge that I think all of the printmakers who worked with Jill at the time benefited enormously from learning a range of new techniques. And I'm mentioning that because technique is quite an important part of this conversation. And then a couple of years after that first trip, you opened your workshop here. I was still working with David at that time, and around about the same time, Mikhail was opening a studio in the same space, next door to where we're sitting now. So there's a nice kind of synchronicity. I don't know when you two first met each other. A couple of months ago, okay. So, and I remember one of the earliest installations in your studio were the Ponte images. And I'm mentioning that because I just came down Joe Slovo past Ponte. And I was thinking a little bit about the kind of trajectory of the many trajectories, in fact, of Mikhail's work as a photographer. And I think that what makes this a really interesting working relationship, apart from obviously a shared interest in the technique of photogravure, which is the project that you've been busy with over the last couple of weeks, is really a kind of very deeply embedded conceptual strain in your work, Mikhail. I think that you have never been a photographer who can be easily categorized as one thing or another. You're interested in images as well as in ideas. And the Ponte work is a good example of a project that really is interested in not so much the way things look, although that's a very important part of the aesthetic of that project, but in the kinds of dynamics that generate that kind of work. And the other important thing about that project is, of course, your collaboration with Patrick Waterhouse. And so working with a printmaker extends your way of working, I would imagine, and stretches your way of working in a variety of ways. So I wonder, maybe we can start to talk about that question, the question of collaboration, which is a very important one for printmakers. And I think that probably, as you both know, the most important thing is that you have to kind of like each other in order to do this kind of work, or at least you have to get each other on some level. And so I wonder if, Phil, you could start off talking about Mikhail's work, your interest in his work, and why you would be working with someone like Mikhail.
That's a good place to start. For me, as a collaborating printer, being that I've worked with a lot of different artists who have very different conceptual as well as aesthetic goals in mind with their work, whether it be in print or their primary medium, the thing that I'm always most looking for to be able to have a successful project is someone who is willing to evolve their work. Because print, especially if you're not a printmaker yourself, you work in another medium primarily, you need to be able to rely on another person or group of people to help you realize your ideas. And you need to be open enough to those new techniques and ways of working and external input so that your work can grow. So an artist who basically already knows exactly what they want, and I say, well, if you can do it in your studio, do it in your studio. It's the best place for that to happen. It's those problems that you can't particularly solve right now on your own that are the more interesting to bring in and create an environment that produces productive work, work that really should only exist in this way. And so for me, what I liked about Mikhail's work initially, having seen the exhibition at MoMA in New York and then seen the Retinal Shift book, for me, the change that I saw from that one body of work to the next body of work was indicative of an artist who is interested in conceptual as well as creative evolution. So it's not that there's a larger theme that's the goal, not a way of working. And so that for me already set it up in a way that I knew he'd be open to evolving artistically or being able to bring his ideas into a medium that was not his primary medium.
So it sounds to me that part of this, part of the way of working, and I know it's true of printmaking in general, is that you're interested in artists who don't see technical problems as a hindrance. In fact, they see that as a way to do this kind of evolving that you're talking about.
Or that it's not something they really care about. The process isn't necessarily as important as the goal. And so so that way allows you to tailor the appropriate process for the appropriate outcome. So you can use every tool that you have at your disposal, as far as printmaking would be concerned, to achieve the goals that you're going for creatively. So for me, it's if someone comes in and something has to be done a certain way, that's more difficult to deal with than a result that has to be achieved. So I love the specificity of a result not being tied to a specific solution or path, because then that allows me to do the most for the artist that I'm working with. So like for Mikhail, he didn't have a preconceived notion of exactly how he wanted photogravure to work for him or to look for him, but he had a conceptual result that made sense to experiment through that medium. So that was a really good foundation for us to start a project from, because he didn't come to me and say, reproduce this exactly like this to do exactly this. So he came to me and said, I have this idea, here are these base images, let's see what this can do, and then he responded to that. And that creates the ideal situation for both of us to get the most out of it, and for something to be achieved that would never have happened without the two of us working together, which is really the goal, is that the work that is produced is a result of the parts that combine, and that wouldn't have happened any other way. That's really the goal from a printer's perspective, that's really what I'm working for.
So Mikhail, maybe you can talk a little bit about how this relationship has worked for you. What has made it interesting for you? What have been the challenges of working with Phil on, I'm sure there are many.
Didn't know we were going there that fast.
I mean, this is a therapy session. You can get it all out.
I have enough of those, thank you. it's interesting how it's worked out for me because of the timing, and, you know, I've obviously been in close proximity to the David Crit workshop and Jill, and I know everybody. And you know, Jill was reminding me that years ago we spoke about we should do something together, and I just never really kind of imagined how that could happen. How I've always looked at what they do and liked some things and like not so much other things, but always been interested in it, but never really related it to me. And then Jill and Phil just kind of arrived at my studio in the midst of the show that I was doing at Goodman earlier this year. And they, you know, the fact that they kind of came to me and kind of presented all these possibilities just in conversation at first was like a really, really special thing for me. And I was pretty exhausted by that show and didn't really, it wasn't like Phil said, it wasn't something like I was like, I imagined this possible outcome and then like really wanted to achieve it, which is I think often how I work. Like if I have an idea for a film or something, I kind of picture it fully formed. And in many ways, then it's about kind of working to fill in the substance of it. This was the opposite. It was just substance at first, a conversation. And then we started working, and it worked out for me to go to Orlando and start making plates with Phil in another studio. And then we had this week last week here, and I mean, basically, I just feel like the luckiest guy in the world because I'm working not just with Phil, with Jill and the whole team here, and they're all like highly skilled individuals who are helping me play around. And collaboratively speaking, I mean, it's like landing with your bum in the butter, really. So I'm incredibly grateful just that this has happened, and to David for like making it happen, and everybody. It's like, and I think part of what's been special about it for me is that it hasn't been like a big kind of goal of mine. It's just been something that's been made possible, and I think I've allowed myself to be a lot more kind of experimental and playful than I would have otherwise if it had been like a design project in my head.
Have you found that working with prints has introduced a greater degree of uncertainty into the project? Is it less clearly, I mean, you've both seemed to suggest that it's less clearly goal-driven as it is process-driven, although there is a goal in mind, but a lot of things happen along the trajectory towards that goal that introduce the possibility of chance and changes to the ultimate outcome. Is that new, or are you accustomed to that dynamic in the various projects that you do?
For me, in some ways, it's consistent because I think, like you say, I've made very both conscious and unconscious decisions in along the years about trying to work in new ways, both formally and conceptually. So I think there's, and I've realized that that's just how I choose and need to work, is that there's meaning for me in not knowing how to do what I'm trying to do. And I often curse myself for it because I feel like I'm not kind of building on the strengths of what I've learned, you know, about photography initially, formally, ways of working with other people, filmmaking, which has been a big part of the last 6 years. And so that feeling of working, not knowing how exactly to do what you're doing, is something that I think is very valuable, but also very difficult. But when you're in the studio surrounded by like all these skilled people, not, you know, Phil also contributes a huge amount in terms of his knowledge, the history of the printmaking medium, and how that relates to my own work. So it's an incredibly supported environment for that type of not knowing.
So I want to, the process of photogravure, I mean, you've been doing a number of processes in the workshop, but primarily your sort of base process is the photogravure.
We're going to spiral
from that. Exactly. It's a really difficult process for a layperson to get their heads around. I think we have some perception of how photography works, and we know that photography is particularly photography which relies on negatives and the production of negatives is requires light. So photogravure basically operates on the same principles, but there are a whole range of much more complicated technical processes involved in photogravure. And I'm sure there are lots of lay people here who have a sense of what photogravure is. We've probably all seen a photogravure without really knowing what it is we're looking at. So, Phil, maybe you could start just by talking us through how you make a photogravure plate, and then we'll talk about why, because that's also an important question.
Wildly different conversation on the why.
Yeah.
In really quick kind of terms, give you a little snippet of the history of photography. So photography in and of itself, as it very early began, was about using essentially volatile, unstable compounds like photosensitized iron is the early parts. So where light would hit it and it would oxidize or change that iron in the surface of a material so that it would allow you to expose an image where light had hit versus where light had not. And so it's just the general is photography was always about the capturing of light for that particular period of time or moment. And so in the early days of photography, it was very difficult because every photograph, as we'll call them photographs, were unique. So like a daguerreotype, a tintype, they were very labor intensive. Photogravure was really the first time you could print the same image consistently. And so this process was developed a way of basically sensitizing a sheet of gelatin to be light sensitive, adhering that to a copper plate, exposing that, and then etching that image into the copper that could then be wiped like any engraving or mezzotint or etching. And the reason for technology going in that way was that intaglio print processes were a primary way of producing images at the time or reproducing images for whether it be for books or posters or things like that. So it was taking a technology of reproducibility and applying it to photography for the first time. So from a historic standpoint, it was about trying to achieve a multiple of a photograph in a cost-effective way. So that way you come into town as a mobile photographer, photogravure producer, you have your little wagon with your horse and you did all your plate making in the back of a wagon out in the prairie, take somebody's photograph, they could make 50 of them for themselves and their family and friends and move on to the next town. So it was that was really its inception. And if you fast forward to today, it's obviously we don't need it for the same purpose because we can just take a picture on our phone and digitally send that image to a printer in another country and have it printed out as many times as we'd like. So from a process perspective, now it's more about the qualities that that particular process can afford a photographer. So from a basic technical, that's about as, without getting crazy detail, that's, okay. Is that enough?
Yeah, that's good. Then there are a couple of other terms that we're gonna use, I think. We're gonna use the term chinkulé. So, Mikhail, you can tell us what chinkulé is. That's for the lay people.
It would be a disservice of me to explain it when Phil
so
can
Phil can
play, contextualize it for Ben.
Yeah.
Chinkulé is a bastardization of the term China collage and from French, which would mean, so in early book printing production, movable type and imagery, so predominant imagery of the time for books, we're talking late 1400s, early 1500s, would be wood engravings, woodblock engravings, and those to be printed as relief prints to make a book. And the type was metal predominantly at the time, and so the metal would hold up longer than the image and pressure differences would break down the image more. So what they started doing was taking very cheap Chinese paper, hence China collage or chinkulé, and they would print these tiny wood engravings and glue them into the books. So that's how the images got into books. And images being tapped into books goes all the way up into the early 80s until photolithography gets better as a color printing process. So chinkulé is the idea of putting an image printed from one surface, sticking it to another.
And can I just jump in? Those two explanations are kind of highly relevant to the why, which I think you're going to get to next, because it brings together two strands of my work. A lot of, obviously my background's in photography, but a lot of the work that I've been doing in the last 6, 7, 8 years has involved found images, which are collaged or torn apart in some sort of form. And that strand comes out of book collecting. So, you know, I've collected books for many years, and actually I only heard the relationship of Chinkalay to the tipping in of early images in books on this trip, you know, a week ago. And it just makes so much sense, because a lot of the kinds of books that I'm interested in come from that kind of history of popular publishing. And it just feels entirely appropriate to be doing or to be trying to find relationships between that kind of collaged found image with photographic images. So the two technical aspects really align with my two of the strands of my interests in images.
And one thing I would like to point out is the difference between Chinkalay and collage. Because there's a really big difference between the two. And a lot of times you think, oh, you just take an image and stick it over here, that's Chinkalay. Chinkalay is more about transparency. And collage is more about opacity or coverage. So when you collage something, you put glue on it and you stick it on and it covers up predominantly what's there. Even if it's a semi-transparent paper, it still has a certain amount of coverage, especially from the opacity of the glue. Chinkalay, on the other hand, pulls the two pieces of paper together. So it, instead of sitting on top like this, it's merging in and they become one. And that level of transparency becomes a benefit to the artist, because you can determine how translucent you would like things to become, which is really the way that Mikhail's been using the process, is to decide what he wants to reveal, how much gets to come through, and how that layering creates a single whole rather than separate parts stuck onto each other.
Can I jump in one more time? And this goes back to something that I wanted to say earlier in response to your kind of questions around the genesis of working together and collaboration. So when I first met Phil, he had just seen the show at Goodman Y, and there were a number of what I call sticky tape transfers on that show, which have a certain place in my practice and are ongoing. But when Phil came to my studio and we were just chatting about work, never mind what we were going to do, I was talking about real kind of formal, problems that I was having in trying to find the relationship between the torn apart image and the ground. And I think I expressed to him some of my frustrations about the inability to resolve certain works that, you know, were just lying around or on the walls in the studio. And it was very much Phil's response to those problems that I was describing that really made me excited to work with him, because I got a sense that there were other tools out there that would help me. And that's very much like I'm only realizing now where he was going with that when we've really gotten stuck into Chinkalay in particular. And we've really been able to work around things that I was struggling to resolve in the studio.
So my sense of the work that you've been doing over the last couple of weeks is that there are multiple processes happening, and that you've started with a kind of a founding image, but by no means stays with that image. It seems from what you're saying that you brought into the studio the idea of cut-up images, for want of a better word, or you were doing kind of sticky tape images, kinds of collaging. You were experimenting with dissecting, with cutting up images and superimposing them or aligning them on top of or next to other images. And it seems that that's exactly what you've been pursuing over the last couple of weeks. But I want to talk about that, kind of what I'm thinking of. It may not be so in your own mind when you think about this project. It might be that other elements of the project are as important or more important, but certainly it's the most, it's the densest image, which is the self-portrait that begins, that from which, you know, the other things seem to kind of take off. So I have both a kind of conceptual question around that image and a technical question. First of all, why would you not simply make a photograph? And this is a question for the printmaker. Why would you just not make a really nice, you know, black and white or color digital print on really beautiful paper with what is both conceptually and technically and aesthetically, what is the difference for you between a digital print or even a print made in a darkroom?
Yeah.
So, and a photogravure.
It's a very simple answer, I guess. This photogravure allows you to use an incredible black ink, which just kind of like pulls you in and makes you want to cry. I had a sense of that before, but then looking at the medium more when we started working together, which is interesting also for me because very rarely worked with black and white photography, but also really wanted to separately from this. So there's that, and then there's what Phil describes as the kind of 3D quality of the ink. It literally is sculptural, you know, the inks are sitting at different levels in the paper, and that gives you this kind of tonal range and tonal modulation that I don't think you could get in the darkroom. And so there's that, but then there's also for me this, like, I find the printing of photographs a very difficult thing. It's by definition, often it's collaborative. I've worked with a lot of different printers here and in America and in Germany, and I've always found, at times I've found great relationships, but then something happens and there's a move and then it's difficult. So I often say I hate the whole process of printing photographs, especially when it comes to editioning and with digital technology, it's so hard to keep it consistent, and then, you know, something changes and you get new inks and then you have to retest everything. I hate the amount of time I spent just trying to keep things consistent. And the whole idea of editioning and photography is this false premise which gives the work value in the art market, but it's nonsense. You know, that's what Benjamin described as the defining nature of photography is its reproducibility. So we limit these editions to provide value, and it just feels like a very unsatisfactory thing. So the idea of working with photography and the attempt to make a very fine, beautiful print, but in a tradition where editioning has meaning, because you can only print the plate so many times and you can break that plate and you know, limit it in a real rather than a virtual way, was quite attractive to me.
Right. So photography's borrowed the idea of editioning in order to add value to work, but it's really quite random, actually. Yeah,
totally.
It's arbitrary.
Yeah, it's totally arbitrary.
False.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
It's a commodity market manipulation technique.
Right, right.
I mean,
that's
what it is.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I mean, from the standpoint of photogravure,
right? You really only can make how many can you make out of a plate?
Even if you steel face it, which is the process of putting a very thin, on a molecular level, coating of iron. It's not actually steel; it's pure iron over the surface of copper. You really don't want to exceed that kind of 50-60 range because you have to replace the iron, and every time you replace the iron, you can remove a very small amount of copper. And in the terms of photogravure, that is noticeable because we're talking about continuous tone. So if you take a very minimal amount off, your highlights get a little brighter. And then you do it again, they get even brighter. And so there's this degradation that will occur on that plate, even with contemporary steel-facing technology. It is limited in that sense, and you will never make the exact same plate twice,
so,
no matter how good you are.
Yeah. So, the difference then, there are many differences, but it seems that one of the kind of fundamental differences is that the objectness of the image changes. That you have something whose objectness comes to mean something completely different from the objectness of a photograph that is printed digitally and can be reproduced hundreds and hundreds, you know, ad infinitum. And it seems that that's a very important aspect of this project, is creating a set of objects rather, as well as a set of images, but images that happen to have a kind of object quality or an object value to them that's different from
I think that's what you've been really working on in your studio right now too, is taking your photographic and your film practice towards a more object-oriented kind of final output for a portion of your work. And I think that's what interested me working together at this time, was he was already going down that road of that kind of creating of an object road with the tools that he has at his disposal and his way of working. And so as a printer's collaborator's goal, it was about letting him rely on his strengths artistically and not have to worry about the technical, so that he could really focus on when something comes back to him, he can assess what works for him and what doesn't, and it gives us a clear direction. Rather than having to obsess with how something was necessarily put together, you can go, that works for me, that doesn't, this works for me, and then it goes immediately in another direction that produces something of value for you.
Yeah, I'm slightly uncomfortable with the emphasis on the objectness of the print, because I'm quite cynical about this kind of, I'm going to get the word wrong, fetishization of, it's kind of part of this kind of nostalgia that you see in photography for old processes. And like, actually, that was like this alarm bell that went off in my head when we were talking about photogravure, is like, why, exactly, why? And I see a lot of people using old cyanotypes and tinotypes, and it's just about the technique, not about anything. So I think I wanted to avoid that. And I think that's a way of leading into some direction I know you wanted to go in, is the initial photographs that I took. I took four self-portraits, in fact, that were the starting point for this project. There was a sense that it kind of fitted in with where I was going in my mind in terms of the work I wanted to be doing, because I've started a cycle of work centered around T.S. Eliot's four quartets. And perhaps the most obvious and on the surface element of that text is time. And so obviously photography fits in, working with photographic processes that that emphasize the kind of crystallization of time, as opposed to digital, for instance. So the four self-portraits I shot on film, I guess I took the self-portraits very instinctively. You know, I couldn't quite get my head around why I was taking self-portraits in this way. And this was a very important thing for me, because I think I try and over-understand everything I put out into the world. And so it was quite nice for me to do things without having figured it all out in my head and just do them, because there was this opportunity to do it. And so we went to Orlando and we made plates for these self-portraits. And we were printing them, and I was learning about how the plates were made and about the possibilities of these black and white photography of prints. And one day I was kind of looking at them with Phil, and I said, I wish I could just put them in a drawer and not see them for 30 years.
You did four self-portraits. Did you make four different, did you choose one as the sort of the key image, or did you make four different?
No, there's four different self-portraits. And
okay.
I think it's just been the process that we've worked more with one. But ultimately they're equal. You know, they're the four quartets, four aspects of looking at myself. So I was saying that jokingly, you know, because I was like, in 30 years' time, I'll really understand why I had the instinct to make these particular self-portraits. And yet I didn't feel like I wanted them to be in the world right now, in the form that they were, but I kind of had this affection for them. And Phil was like, yeah, we should do that. Let's make a time capsule. So, and obviously he was responding to what I was exploring in relation to the four quartets. So we decided to do that, is to make a time capsule.
Well, let me interject a little bit. there's an aspect of this too that I think needs to be pointed out, which is something I think can be taken for granted because of the ease at which he says it, which is his willingness to say, I've made something that I don't understand fully, and I believe it has value, but I don't know what that value is yet. That's a really big thing to be able to, one, admit to yourself, and two, to admit to a crowd of people, and three, let us all be part of that discovery process, which is very rare for many artists. Many artists wall off that part of their creative process from the rest of the world, and so for me, in responding to that, a lot of my response was watching how he reacted to the photogravure images, which we had originally intended to do in one way, but he was also responding to a lot of the process stuff that occurs, like the scales that we put on and these weird little things that normally we would cut off. And to him, he was really liking how that became even more genuine. And it was allowing it to be more of what it was, rather than trying to force it into being something else. And it was that openness that really said to me, well, this needs to, we really should think about keeping a record of this in this particular way, because it has a resonance with you that you're willing to go out on that limb and be that honest about everything with someone who you didn't know very well at the time, that, and that trust there. So for me, the reciprocation was an acknowledgement of that trust and an acknowledgement of that desire to be able to reflect upon itself critically in the future, which most people won't reflect on themselves critically right now, let alone being willing to do that in any time down the road. So for me, that was a really telling aspect about who Mikhail is as a person and as an artist. And it was something that needed to be kind of embraced to see where that would go. And I think ultimately what it did was created a nice foundation for the works that have then subsequently been produced and that will be produced, because it's basically acknowledging that not knowing exactly how something's going to happen or what value something may have in the future is an important thing to acknowledge right now.
Surely it also means the risk that it will have no value.
Exactly.
Or that its value will, there's that. And also, I mean, value is a very multi-dimensional word, because when we talk value, we're talking about money, and we're talking about kind of cultural value or aesthetic value or kind of social value. So, you know, what does it mean to say that something acquires value over time? And, you know, maybe you can talk a little bit about,
Well, I mean, it's interesting. The idea came from me saying, I want to put these away in the drawer in my studio and see what they look like in 30 years' time. It really started, and I don't say this lightly, in a very kind of genuine emotional relationship to the images kind of way. And then when we started talking about it, of course, then we like riffed on the ideas in relation to four quartets and time, in relation to the kind of conceptual element of what it means to, and in terms of value, market value. So like, if we could persuade a museum to buy a set of four prints that they can only open in 10 years' time, what does that mean? What are they buying? You know, and that that relates to a lot of conceptual art in the last 40 years. It kind of links printmaking into a very different type of practice. And we got excited about things like the packaging that we're going to put these four prints in. So Phil's idea was to use an inter-office envelope. Where there's a seal and a string, and any person whose hands it comes into has to sign for it. So you get a kind of record of its kind of, and it's invalidated if it's open before the date that we set. So it just felt like, after the initial impulse, it felt like a very appropriate thing to be doing with these particular images. And it also allowed us to kind of spin out into all the other things that we're doing from the starting point of that images with different form, with elements of photogravure, chincalet, direct gravure. Printmaking is amazing because you're in the studio and you try one thing, and then the moment you see it, you're like, oh, I could do that on its own with a different image, and you're like constantly doing new things. So I think what was valuable about that was it was allowed us to say, okay, we've made these images, we've put all this effort into taking the photographs, making the plates, you know, across continents, which was a significant amount of effort and expense and everything. And let's allow it to be something and relevant, but we don't have to commit to what it is now. We can just put it away and then spin ourselves out into these new things.
And we don't have to be so precious with it then.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think that was, because we're gonna, it will have its own life at some point as is, that preciousness gets to go away, and it freed him up to then cut them up. And I think that's what really opened up a lot of the print process for him, was that ability to like let that beautiful thing go so that you could do something else with it or find other points of value for him creatively in that process. And I mean, the other thing, I mean, that's an obvious thing to kind of say, but I think we should say it, is that, I mean, your film that you've spent several years working on, your most recent film, is essentially a giant time capsule. So when he was like, "Well, I would love to put this away," I was like, "Well, I just saw your film, which is a giant time capsule." I was like, this kind of makes sense for you as an artist, because you're kind of obsessed with how things are perceived or valued over time, and what's great distances and great lengths of time. And so this is really an acknowledgement and a very practical way that allows you to talk about the art market, talk about the value of time, and also reflect upon your own work. It kind of encapsulated to me virtually everything you'd been doing for the last decade in one very graceful project. So it made complete sense to me, especially given your most recent film. So it wasn't like a weird stretch.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about the images. You've produced a range of images in the studio, apart from the self-portrait. And these seem to me, again, in keeping with some of the impulses that you've been kind of following over the last couple of years, to be a kind of direct deconstruction of the photographic process, particularly of the completed image, or the image as a kind of index of one thing, of either an event or a thing or a person. So the photograph as a record. And you seem to want to, as you have just said, cut up, literally, both technically and conceptually, cut up the photograph, or kind of explode the photograph, or, you know, put something on top of the photograph. What leads you in that direction, and what is it, what's that process about?
It's all about mistrust. I really, I have a show on in Cape Town at the moment, and I think I finally found words for it, for that show that relates completely. You know, it really comes from mistrust of images on so many levels, of how they operate in the world, how I approached making them as a photographer, and so I see the cutting up as more as pulling apart in order to try and literally climb inside those images in terms of my processes and understand how they're operating. And this is all kind of retrospectively me thinking about it, but I think the aim is to put them together in a way that is more honest, that somehow reveals the dishonesty of the way that they were working before. And I don't necessarily mean intentional dishonesty. I mean, you have advertising, which I think is very consciously dishonest, but I think representation, for me, especially thinking about the history of photography and documentary photography, is so much about, almost an unconscious splitness or dishonesty in psychological terms of how images are operating and communicating, and the relationship between the author of those images and the image itself and the subject. I think I've almost like labored the point of the past. When was Retinal Shift? That was like 2012, which for me was this like kind of that, my kind of work turned around that project. It was bang in the middle of the Ponte project, which was the third of these big kind of documentary projects that I'd done. And so that's 6 years ago. I think I've really labored the point in those 6 years of trying to find different ways of pulling apart and getting inside of those images. And what's interesting about this project is, even though I'm still cutting things up and recombining them, I see it as kind of hitting rock bottom and in a way wanting to turn around and start constructing again, making things as opposed to pulling things apart. And I think even though we have pulled them apart, the making of those four self-portraits was an important point for me, in my process.
It's interesting to hear the kind of inherent contradiction in what you're saying, which I think is it's a fruitful contradiction, because on the one hand, you're suggesting that the photograph is something that purportedly documents the world in some way or has a relationship to the world as we know it in some way is is to be mistrusted. Whether and that's not a negative thing necessarily, it's just that we look at it, we know now that we don't look at photographs and really believe that they represent the world. But at the same time, we continue to produce photographs as if they do that work. And it would seem to me that that breaking apart the photographic image is a kind of deliberate attempt to point to its failure to represent, and then to approach representation from a completely different, in a completely different way. So in other words, if you're taking a series of found images, and if you're taking apart some of your own images and combining that, it means that your construction of the image is radically different from technically and conceptually from the way you would construct an image inside of a photograph, of a single photograph. And that seems to me to be part of what this collaboration has been exploring.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it's about allowing photography to be honest. I think because we want it to be honest. We want photography. I think on some level we want to believe what we see. It's still an interpretation, but I think on a certain level, a lot of us want to believe what we see on a basic level, even though every one of us approaches an image with a varying degrees of skepticism. You know, it's more like a continuum of skepticism that we're all on it somewhere. And I think the way in which he's really kind of hammering home that you may not be getting across what you intend as the photographer, especially like with a lot of your found imagery. It's the originator of that image may have had a specific intention, and an intention may not have been able to even hold for a day, let alone a decade or 100 years worth of time. And that by going back to it and finding value for himself in certain things and recombining with other things, I feel like he's trying to be as honest as he can with how to present that back to us.
Isn't it that the question is no longer important, actually? That when you make images in this way, the question of its honesty has a completely different... It doesn't seem to me... I mean, I have some trouble with the word honesty, I must say.
I do mean it in a particular way that might make more sense to me than anybody else. I think I say it in relation to psychological honesty, which is about wholeness, about because I feel like the defining aspect of my experience of the world is that in order to operate, especially in South Africa, but actually anywhere in the world, we have to split ourselves. We have to split these truths that are these multiple truths that all are true, but kind of contradict each other. So we do that by shutting off aspects of what we know of the world and ourselves, and only holding one thing true. And it's impossible to live in South Africa with the realities around us without doing that to some extent. You'd go mad, I think, if you didn't. So for me, it's about that, and honesty is about wholeness more than like intentional honesty or dishonesty. So perhaps that clarifies a little bit, but there's definitely also been a lot of anger in the way that I've pulled images apart and smashed them, and that's anger at myself for not being more conscious of why I was making those images. It's anger at the situations that are in those images. It's anger at the reception of the images in the context where they're shown. And I think to some degree, I mean, you can only do that so long. And I think part of what's interesting about this project and the work that I've been doing for the show in Cape Town is that I've made photographs for these processes, and it's allowed me to let go of some of the cynicism and anger and say, okay, one can create something actually, rather than just try and break what I've been doing for all this time. And I made, for the show, the Y show, I made two kind of large-scale photographs that were very much part of the sticky tape transfer process of pulling apart, but they actually had very photographic qualities. in traditional photographic ways, and similarly with some of these images that I've made for this project. And it's gone beyond the four self-portraits now. So I've made another kind of, I don't know what to describe it, kind of landscape image photograph. And there's some still lives that we've spoken about, a lot about being the kind of next phase. So I think it's very nice for me to almost be able to move back towards trust. Move back towards trust in the creative process.
It sounds like pleasure to me, actually. Pleasure, it sounds like, rather than trust, it sounds like you're having, that the process of exploring is pleasurable. The process of finding new ways of making images is pleasurable. And it produces a certain kind of fulfillment, which may or may not be related to the value of the images. It's all about the process that you're engaged in. So Phil, you can tell us what we're looking at, apart from
Technically what you're looking at, the black portrait of Mikhail is photogravure. What you're looking at the bottom is it's a variation of a Stover scale or a step scale, which allows you to, when you're etching the plate, to gauge the value range of that particular plate. And what you're looking at here is an inkjet on a very thin paper called Gompi. It's a digital sheen collet. So we're actually seeing and you can see the edge here, two very, very thin sheets of paper that have been sheen colleted together to allow this image to come through the hole that he's cut out. And from a feeling perspective, you really can't feel that edge. They become one piece of paper. So when we talk about sheen colet, it's about that blending. So he worked on selection of an image as well as selecting where to cut out to allow what that would show through. And this is the beginnings of a run that will have a different kind of cascade of boxes that go through. And then we have this one, which I think is kind of a natural exploration of a similar process. So this is, again, two very thin pieces of paper, two thin sheets of Gompi. One which he wrote on and drew on with different colored pens, and the other which he printed out digital inkjet photograph. And those were then sheen collated together, one on top of the other. So the text is actually behind. And each time we run it through the press with another damaged sheet of paper, it gains in transparency. And we stop when he says, "I like it." So it allows that text to kind of come through and bleed through. And so from a physical standpoint, the photographic image of him is actually closer to us. And so we're trying to gain that level of transparency and translucency. So these were two different directions, utilizing similar processes, and you kind of get an understanding when he was talking about the black quality. So when you look at the black here versus the black here, because we can alter this color differently, and it's a physical thing versus what's, so the ink here is on the paper, the ink here is in the paper. Does that make sense? So that's really what we're going for. So this is giving you kind of an idea of two of the images that were kind of spiraling out of these processes. So working proofs. Any questions?
I have a question involved on bonds. One question where you asked about the archivability or your photographic role as an archiver in relation to your newer works, which is more fragmented archivalism. Now, for me, your type of subject matter that you deal with is you don't allow us as viewers to romanticize some aspects, like, for example, Paul Smoor and President Nelson Mandela's association, and, for example, Ponte, which has an iconic value in Johannesburg, and how that has changed. So with your new fragmented works, you use techniques of layering and masking. It almost, for me, I read it almost as a type of censorship. So what type of, what role does censorship now play in your recent works, or these new
things? I think you're right. The word censorship definitely comes into it. But for me, it's more about the processes of taking away and adding. So with the sticky tape transfers, I often work with multiple images and I pull ink away from one and then add them to another. And it becomes this kind of formal battle between the resolution of the images. As you take more from the one, the new image forms more, but you lose more of being able to kind of see and take in the other image. And I think there's something kind of fundamentally interesting for me about that kind of battle between pulling apart and constructing, which is relates, you know, to these bigger kind of trajectories. I think to answer your question more directly, part of what I've really wanted to do in my work is to get in the way of the viewer's ability to just consume that image. So I found with a lot of my works, I was representing very painful, difficult things about the world and trying to make them comprehensible and transparent, and yet you put those photographs up or you put them in a book or a magazine and they are kind of just consumed in a very, a kind of unthinking kind of way for their beauty or for for a direct political message that might not be, you know, that's not nearly as nuanced as I was trying to put across. So I think it started with the smashing of the photographs where I was literally getting in the way of the viewer's ability to consume it. And I think I have, and I also wanted to self-censor a lot of those images. I want to cover up things that I wish I had never really uncovered. And so, yeah, I think it's an interesting word in relation to what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think a word that kind of comes with censorship a lot is revelation, too. You know, it's with what you hide reveals a whole other set of things on why you're hiding what you're hiding and what you're left with, and the kind of that search or the quest for what is missing or why something is missing. And I think, so I kind of feel you have to throw that word in there too. And I think a lot of, especially with like kind of that photogravure image that has the cutout, and then, so his intention, you know, is to have a series of those where you'll never actually get to see the complete image of either one. But you kind of have to look at this whole to try to get a sense of what either image may have actually been. And I think a lot of what you're working with is in some ways is slowing people down to actually have to think about it versus just consume the image.
Yeah, I think what it does, what both of you are saying, is that it changes the viewer's relationship to the image and it changes the viewer's relationship to the maker of that image. So there's a dynamic that's introduced into the viewing process that is radically different from the viewing of a photograph. It just, there's some quite fundamental shift that happens. And it's almost as though you're throwing the reading process back onto the viewer. You're not allowing the reader, and I'm talking about the viewer, to simply, you're using the word consume, to just kind of swallow the image whole.
But this arrogance of the viewer, the assumption that one has the kind of divine right to consume in this way, and I include myself in this because I'm a consumer of images as much as anybody else. And I think, yeah, it's about disrupting that process, because censorship is interesting. I mean, it's got almost universally negative connotations, but actually I think sometimes it can be productive to censor. Sometimes it can be productive not to say what one just wants to say, and, you know, vomit out on social media. I think it's also a political act in South Africa right now. You know, there's so much noise and there's so much contestation about things to say and who has the right to say what. And it's not that I'm advocating censorship, but I think that sometimes it's important. Yeah, like I have a big bugbear about freedom of speech and the kind of narratives around freedom of speech right now. And I think that freedom of speech is not the most important thing in the world.
Sometimes space is important.
Yep.
Having a little bit of time. And I think censorship can provide, if you self-censor something you may say, it can provide you with some time to maybe think about or evolve a position. Whereas if it's always going out, it becomes more difficult for an individual to, say, change or acknowledge that they may have been wrong or to be able to evolve in a position. And so I think sometimes just creating that little bit of space, that little bit of lag time, allows for that evolution of thought or thought to have time to occur. It's essentially what the time capsule is, bringing it all back home.
Yeah, I just wanted to show one more image because, this for me was really interesting. So what we didn't explain technically is we spoke about the photogravure, which is here, the digital Schenker layer, which is here, but there's another layer, which is direct gravure, which is was also interesting to me because I never thought I'd be able to like take a etching tool and make etched drawings. I have a very particular way of drawing and writing, and with a very particular pen, like it's the only pen I can use. It sounds stupid, I know. But like what was amazing, it was full, and the team found a way of like translating that into a copper plate in itself, which means that, so all the writing here was made into a gravure plate as well, which means that we can change the color, we can print it in different kinds of ways. And it was also really interesting for me how Phil kind of pointed me towards this very particular quality in the way that I was making marks, which I didn't actually assign any value to. But just in the way he responded to what I was doing in preparing stuff and sketching out ideas, he like highlighted something that I think that actually, for me, works really interestingly formally here. So it was just fantastic for me to like, it was almost like the discovery of like this thing that I can do that that then knitted the images together in a way that not only did I really like, but it actually felt like true to the kind of things that I want to do and like doing. So for me, this points in the direction of things that I want to do a lot more of.
I mean, for me, where it came from is I'm always looking for, when I'm working with an artist, what feels natural to them and what allows them to express themselves most confidently. So watching the way he would draw over a photograph, only a photographer draws on a photograph in this particular way, because you're like, oh, I need highlight here, and you take, and it's this, there's a fluidity with the way in which you use like kind of diagramming in order to break an image apart so you can produce it in exactly the way you want. So photographers have a very specific way of drawing, and so when Mikhail was being like, oh, I don't necessarily want to do that, and I'm just watching him draw, I was just like, hey, by the way, you're drawing. We can do that. And so, because a lot of people don't, they take for granted the things that they're most comfortable with as being something that is potentially valuable because it's something you do all the time. And so for someone who's, say, a painter, that way a paintbrush sits in the hand, it becomes an extension of the hand. And someone who's been painting for a long time will take for granted that this particular brand and this number of brush, they can make do anything, right? They don't even think about it. And so for me, sometimes it's like you kind of have to point out some of the obvious to help take away concern that you're not going to be able to achieve what it is that you want to achieve.
And,
so.
And I mean, I don't want to, I know it's sounding like we're just patting each other on the back, but I mean, as an artist,
big love vest.
What could be more valuable than having some guy walk into your studio and like point out things that you're doing anyway that have meaning to you, and then show you a way to like, take that in a whole new direction of making work and getting what was privately meaningful into the world in a way that I think is going to be publicly meaningful. I mean, that's like amazing.
I mean, that's when collaboration works. I'm just going to go on now. I feel like I didn't hear that. But when it works, it just allows everyone to play with their strengths versus forcing people to have to do things over and over that work towards their weaknesses. And I think when collaboration of any kind works, everybody's doing what they're best at. And everybody's voice has equitable value because you're all working towards the same goal. And I think what makes collaborative printing work so well is that the goal is a realization of an aesthetic work that happens to be a print. And so if everyone is working towards that same goal, then you can make something of value happen. Now, whether or not it's technically worth anything to anyone, the whole financier's value-worth relationship, you know, what does it mean to you versus what you're willing to part with for it, And that's a whole different discussion, but you do know that you have a better chance of it being worth something if it is of the greatest value to you. And that value comes of just essentially trusting one another, relying on each other's strengths, and allowing it to work naturally versus putting kind of artificial constraints on a project that can cause it not to fully realize itself. So I think, you know, what we really struggle with is that everybody is particular enough, but open enough. And there's a balance between those two things that you have to strike. So.
Well, the singing has started, so I think that's a good...
That's a hint.
That's a good note to end on. Thank you for a lovely conversation,
thank
both
you,
of you, and we look forward to seeing how this collaboration evolves.
Me too.
And thank you all, and thank you to David and Jill and your team.